Speaker today, the fourth in the contemporary series, is Miss Susan Sontag, presently on leave of absence from Rutgers University, and is working on her second novel under a Rockefeller Foundation grant. She has recently published critical essays in Evergreen Review, Partisan Review, Film Quarterly, and has just completed a collection of her essays to be published this fall entitled Against Interpretation. Her address today is entitled Two Cultures and the New Sensibility. Ms. Sontag.
I want to say two things before I begin. The first is that I have been to about 10 universities and colleges, most cases giving single lectures, some cases participating in sort of group discussions with other invited people, and this is the first time I've ever really enjoyed myself. since I came yesterday, I've been engaged in a continual dialogue with about 10 or 15 students. This never happens anywhere else. I'm talking about places like Princeton and Yale and Brown and a lot of other places. You just get carried off by faculty and entertained very pleasantly, but not very stimulatingly. And I haven't met any faculty yet, but I've met, but I've met a lot of marvelous people, and really, the only pleasure for me thus far in going and lecturing is making some money, which I'm not making here, and in hearing myself, talk. This time, it's something entirely different. It's being able to talk, to engage in a dialogue with a number of kids, 20, 30, that I've met, 10 or so that I've talked at some length with, who know exactly what I'm talking about, in some cases more about what I'm talking about than I do, whom I feel, you know, completely comfortable in terms of my ideas and my sensibility. And I just wanted to tell you this because I wonder if how many of you, if many of you know how unusual a place Antioch is. I certainly didn't know it until yesterday. It also made me feel that I'm bringing coals to Newcastle, that a lot of what I say is going to be extremely obvious to many of you. And if it is so, well, you might be a little bored, but you still are to be congratulated because I assure you it isn't obvious to most people, these things. They come as very revolutionary ideas. I find here everybody knows about this stuff. And so excuse me for thinking that you were like other places. And so preparing to talk about something, I wish I'd known about who you were and what you were, and then I might have tried something a little more specific. And but anyway, this is what I have planned to do, and I'm afraid I can't work up something altogether different on such short notice. The second thing I want to say is very brief, and it's just that I think the name of this talk is One Culture and the New Sensibility. I don't mean that it was wrongly announced. That was the title that I gave David Coldren over the phone the other day when he called me in New York. But the more I think about it, I think I'd rather call it One Culture and the New Sensibility. And you'll see why in a moment. In the last few years, there's been a good deal of discussion of a purported chasm which opened up some two centuries ago with the advent of the Industrial Revolution between two cultures, the literary, artistic, and the scientific. According to this diagnosis, any intelligent and articulate modern person is likely to inhabit one culture to the exclusion of the other. He will be concerned with different documents, different techniques, different problems. He will speak a different language. Most important, the type of effort required for the mastery of these two cultures will differ vastly. For the literary artistic culture is understood as a general culture. It is addressed to man so far as he is man. It is culture, or rather, it promotes culture, culture in the sense defined by Ortega y Gasset as that which a man has in his possession when he has forgotten everything that he has read. The scientific culture, in contrast, culture for specialists, it is founded on remembering, not on what you know after you've forgotten everything that you know. It's founded on remembering. It is set down in ways that require complete dedication of the effort to understand. While the literary artistic culture aims at internalization, ingestion, in other words, cultivation, the scientific culture aims at accumulation and externalization in complex instruments for problem solving and specific techniques of mastery. This is the thesis and very general outline of the two cultures. But T.S. Eliot derived the chasm between the two cultures from a period more remote in modern history than the Industrial Revolution, speaking in a famous essay of a dissociation of sensibility which opened up in the 17th century. The connection of the problem with the Industrial Revolution seems well taken. There is a historic antipathy on the part of many literary intellectuals and artists to those changes which characterize modern society, above all, industrialization and those of its effects which everyone has experienced, such as the proliferation of huge impersonal cities, the predominance of the anonymous style of urban life. It has mattered little whether industrialization, the creature of modern science, is seen on the 19th and early 20th century model as noisy, smoky, artificial processes which defile nature and standardize culture, or whether it's seen on the newer model, the clean, automated technology that's coming into being in the second half of the 20th century. The judgment has been mostly the same. Literary men, feeling that the status of humanity itself was being challenged by the new science and the new technology, abhorred and deplored the change. But the literary men, whether one thinks of Emerson and Thoreau and Ruskin in the 19th century, of 20th century intellectuals, name millions of names, Irving Howe, Lewis Mumford, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, who 20th century intellectuals who talk of modern society as being in some new way incomprehensible, alienated. All these people, 19th century and 20th century people, are inevitably on the defensive because they know, and their arguments reveal this defensiveness, they know that the scientific culture, the coming of the machine, as they characterize it, the scientific culture can't be stopped. Now, one of the notable conclusions drawn from the problem of the two cultures, and I want to make it clear that, as far as I'm concerned, this issue long antedates by many decades, more than many decades, the very philistine and crude statement of it by C.P. Snow in a famous lecture some years ago. I've picked up the label for the problem that he gives it, the two cultures, but I'm not attacking Snow because I don't think Snow is even worth attacking. It's much too simple a statement, not really an interesting statement at all. It just happens to have gotten a lot of publicity, and the phrase is usable and convenient. But I'm not attacking Snow's version of it because that is, as I say, much too simple a statement of the problem. One of the notable conclusions drawn from this problem has been a facile from the awareness of this as a problem, the statement of this as a problem, has been a facile defense of the function of the arts in terms of an ever vaguer ideology of humanism, in quotes, or a premature surrender of the function of the arts to science. I shouldn't say one of the conclusions, I said two of the conclusions. I'm not speaking here of the philistinism of scientists and those among their those of their party among artists and philosophers who dismiss the arts as imprecise, untrue, at best mere toys, people like Carnap or even like Snow himself. There are serious doubts about the role of art and literature, and these are the ones that I want to take up. It must be taken seriously and, if possible, answered. These doubts have arisen among those who are passionately engaged in the arts. The role of the individual artist in the business, can't seem to get my cigarette lit. The role of the individual artist in the business of making unique objects for the purpose of giving pleasure and educating conscience and sensibility has repeatedly been called into question. Some literary intellectuals and artists have gone so far as to prophesy the ultimate demise of the art-making activity of man. art in an automated scientific society would be unfunctional, useless. Let me repeat again that I'm not attempting to deal with or to answer, because again, I don't think it's worth answering, this kind of attack in the mouths of people who know nothing about the arts, who have no commitment to the arts, the new men that Snow writes about. I'm talking about doubts which have arisen on the part of artists and serious intellectuals who nevertheless feel that in some way and for these by reason of these vast historical changes, the game of the arts is up. But this conclusion, I'm going to argue, is unwarranted. In fact, I think the whole issue, the whole question, the whole problem is crudely put and is a kind of pseudo-problem. The question of the two cultures, in quotes, assumes that science and technology are changing in motion, while the arts are static, fulfilling some perennial generic human function like consolation or edification or diversion. Only on the basis of this false assumption that science is changing, dynamic, and the function of the arts is a static or perennial one, only on the basis of this false assumption would anyone reason that the arts might be in danger of becoming obsolete. Now, art does not progress in the sense that science and technology do, but the arts do develop and change. For instance, in our own time, art is becoming increasingly the terrain of specialists. The most interesting and creative art of our time is not open to the generally educated. It demands special effort. It speaks a specialized language. The music of Milton Babbitt and John Cage, the painting of Jasper Johns and Frank Stella, the dance of Merce Cunningham and James Waring, the films of Stan Brakhage. You can add many examples, I'm sure, from your own recent experiences here at the college. All these works demand an education of sensibility whose difficulties and length of apprenticeship are at least comparable to the difficulties of mastering physics or engineering. Among the arts, certainly in America, and this in parentheses, the practice of fiction is a conspicuous exception to this general tendency. The similarity between this feature of contemporary art, that it is addressed to an audience whose sensibility has to be educated, which an audience that has to develop certain skills, and therefore an audience of specialists, as opposed to simply general educated person, the common reader, as Virginia Woolf called them, and so on. The similarity between this feature of contemporary art and the style of modern science is too obvious to be missed. Another likeness with the scientific culture is the history-mindedness of contemporary art. The most interesting works of contemporary art are full of references to the history of the medium. So far as they comment on past art, they demand a knowledge of at least art, at least the art of the recent past. As Harold Rosenberg has pointed out with reference to contemporary painting, contemporary works of art are themselves acts of criticism as much as of creation. The point could well be made, just as well be made, of much recent work in film, music, dance, poetry, and in Europe, fiction. Again, a similarity with the style of science, this time with the accumulative aspect of science, can be discerned. Now, what I'm trying to say is that the conflict between the two cultures is, in fact, an illusion, a temporary phenomenon born of a period of profound and bewildering historical change. What we're witnessing is, in fact, not so much a conflict of cultures as the creation of a new, potentially unitary kind of sensibility. This new sensibility is rooted, as it must be, in our experience, experiences which are new in the history of humanity, experience such as that of extreme social and physical mobility, of the new experience of the crowdedness of the human scene, both people and material commodities multiplying at a dizzying rate, the experience, the availability of new sensations such as speed, for example, physical speed as in airplane travel, speed of images as in the cinema, and a final and very important experience for our sensibility, the pan-cultural perspective on the arts that's possible through the mass reproduction of art objects. The thing that Malraux talks about, the whole world has become a kind of museum without walls, and we can have all kinds of art objects of different periods, moods, styles, structures, juxtaposed simultaneously. There's a kind of collage principle of sensation at work, working upon our sensibility at all levels today, and not just in the realm of art. I mean, you see it in newspapers, you see it in the new urban landscape. What we're getting then is not a demise of art, but a transformation of the function of art. Art which arose in human society as a magical religious operation, that's a whole topic in itself, and passed over into a technique for depicting and commenting on secular reality, the second phase, one we're most familiar with, has in our own time arrogated to itself a new function, which is neither religious or secular, because those distinctions don't matter for us anymore since the alternatives are not equally viable, but something that is beyond that alternative and that polarity. Art functions as a technique for exploring, modifying, and extending consciousness and sensation. Now, the consequences that I draw from this characterization of what I call the new sensibility is that, for example, many of the traditional distinctions that have been developed in the course of intellectual discussion, in some cases explicitly, in some cases implicitly, people accept things and see things this way without even being conscious of it, and many traditional distinctions are now irrelevant and encumbering, and it's very important that they be exposed and that people reflect upon them, because they are there determining our judgment, influencing our judgment, and undermining our openness to new things, whether we know it or not. One of these distinctions, and I'm going to touch on all these matters rather sketchily, because as you can see, what I'm doing is a kind of outline of problems and approaches, and I don't claim to have offered exhaustive arguments for the points that I'm making, but just to indicate the direction of the argument that might be taken. One of the distinctions that seems to me obsolete, irrelevant, encumbering, at the very least worthy of a serious and sustained critical examination, is the distinction between high culture and mass culture, or between serious culture and low culture, and all the various versions of that sort of thing. Another distinction, it seems to me, that has to be very seriously and strenuously re-examined is the difference, the evaluative difference, that is made between the unique object and the mass-produced object, that difference carrying with it a notion of the prestige of the work of art as a unique object. These two, I think, it can be easily seen, are quite connected, these two pairs of distinctions. The traditional view in discussions of culture since the 19th century, and again, I'm going back to people like Arnold and Ruskin and Nietzsche and Burckhardt, and the whole literature in English and in European languages on the problem of modernity, the criticism, the first encounter with the spirit of modernity that goes back easily 100 years ago. The traditional view since the 19th century is to become aware of this new phenomenon, which is called mass culture or popular culture. For a long time, you know, even all films were included by most culture critics in this category. The film, the movie, was seen as, by its very definition, a form of mass culture. It couldn't possibly be a form of high serious art. That the objects of popular culture were seen as having little value because they were manufactured objects bearing no individual stamp, group concoctions made for an undifferentiated audience. It's amazing, by the way, how many people still believe this. Again, I feel that very few of you here will have any idea of the power and authority of these notions, but I might tell you, you know, because it really surprised me, of something that I know of personally. That essay, Against Interpretation, which some of you have read, that was published in Evergreen Review, was originally commissioned by Harold Rosenberg, with whose writings I know a number of you are familiar, and one thinks of Rosenberg as being, critics and intellectuals of an older generation go today, very open and advanced, very open to new things. That was commissioned by Harold Rosenberg for the new magazine that he started called Location, a couple of issues of which have appeared. And when I gave it to him, he told me that he wanted me to rewrite it and take out the examples that I had given from the movies, because he said the movies aren't a serious art. And I said, what do you mean? Because there are a lot of examples. Most of the examples are from novels, plays, and movies. It makes a general point about what are the possibilities of criticism and of interpreting works of art. And I have a lot of examples that are taken from movies. And Rosenberg said, well, there are a few people. He said Chaplin, Eisenstein. But on the whole, he said, a film cannot be a work of art because it's made by a group of people who pool their effort so that there's no personal stamp left. It's like made by a machine. It's in the very nature of the form of, and he's talking about, you know, films made, you know, under studio conditions. Movies cannot be works of art. I assume he would exclude, let's say, movies made by painters for $500 or something like that, but that's an individual thing. But if you mention, and I argue very strenuously with him a whole evening on this, hundreds of films of the last 30 years, he said, well, movies aren't a serious art form. I would never believe that, you know, someone of that degree of openness, it wouldn't surprise me if Lionel Trilling would say it. I'm sure he would say it if he even thought to say it, but it really did surprise me when somebody like Rosenberg said it. So there's still this attitude, and of course, I at one point rather feebly, I was so amazed at this disagreement, which I never expected. I said, "Well, what about Chartres? You know, if you talk about something being not the work of an individual but of a group." And of course, I was quite mistaken to bring that up because that is indeed another kind of example altogether. And we got nowhere, so I took the article elsewhere, since I had no intention of taking out my examples of the movies. But this is a kind of attitude and prejudice which goes back to this original distinction between the work of art as a unique object made by a single person, handicrafted, as opposed to the mass-produced object, the object that's made by a number of people, designed for reproduction, not just something that is made in a single example and then subsequently reproduced, but it is made for the circumstances and conditions of mass reproduction. In the light of contemporary practice in the arts, it seems to me this distinction is extremely shallow, really quite untenable. Most of the serious, or many, I should say, of the serious works of art of recent decades have had a decidedly impersonal character. And the work of art is reasserting its existence as object, even as manufactured or mass-produced object drawing on the popular arts rather than as individual personal expression. I want to, again, explain what I imagine is clear to most of you, that I'm not saying that this kind of impersonal art is better than the art which is clearly individual personal expression. It's not that it's better or worse. It's simply that it is art, an art which represents very serious alternatives, aesthetic alternatives, and there's no reason to rank it lower. It's not that I'm in any way trying to say that it's better either. The exploration of the impersonal and the transpersonal in contemporary art is what might be called the new classicism, at least a reaction against what's understood as the romantic spirit dominates most of the interesting art of today. This romantic spirit is sometimes called sentimentality. Today's art, with its insistence on coolness, its refusal of what it considers to be sentimentality, its spirit of exactness, its sense of research and problems, is closer to the spirit of science than art is closer to the spirit of science than of art in the old-fashioned sense. Often the artist's work is only his idea, his concept. This is a familiar practice in architecture, of course, And one remembers that painters in the Renaissance often left parts of their canvases to be worked out by students, and in the classical period of the concerto, the cadenza at the end of the first movement was left to the inventiveness and discretion of the performing soloist. But similar practices have a different, more polemical meaning today in the present post-romantic era of the arts. When painters such as Joseph Albers, Ellsworth Kelly, and Andy Warhol assign portions of the work, say, the painting in of the colors themselves to a friend, or as in the case of Albers, to the local gardener, when musicians invite collaboration from performers by leaving opportunities for random effects, switching around the order of the score, improvisations, they're changing the ground rules which most of us employ, not most of you apparently, but most other people employ to recognize a work of art. They're saying what art need not be. They're not saying what it has to be, they're saying what it need not be, at least not necessarily. Now, the primary feature of what I'm calling the new sensibility is that, or a primary feature, a way of looking at it, is that the model product is not the literary work. Above all, it's not the novel. A new non-literary establishment, if you want to use that awful word, exists today, of whose very existence, not to mention significance, most literary intellectuals are entirely unaware. This new group of people includes certain painters, sculptors, architects, social planners, dancers and makers of happenings, some filmmakers, TV people, neurologists, musicians, electronics engineers, philosophers, sociologists, and the like. A few poets and prose writers can be included, hardly any. Some of the basic texts for this new wave, this non-literary or a-literary establishment, are to be found in the writings of Nietzsche, Wittgenstein, Artaud, C.S. Sherrington, Buckminster Fuller, Marshall McLuhan, John Cage, Rainer Banham, a very important French critic named Roland Barthes, Siegfried Gideon, Georgi Kepisch, to name only a few. Those who worry about the gap between the two cultures, and this means virtually all literary intellectuals in England and America, take for granted a notion of culture which decidedly needs re-examining. It is the notion perhaps best expressed by Matthew Arnold, in which the central cultural act is the making of literature, which is itself understood as the criticism of culture. Literature is understood as criticism of reality, criticism of culture. Simply ignorant of the vital and enthralling so-called avant-garde developments in the other arts, and blinded by their personal investment in the perpetuation of the older notion of culture, they continue to cling to literature as the model art, and typically to discuss literary works as texts, or even pretexts, for cultural, social, and psychological diagnosis, not discussing them at all as works of art. What gives literature for these people its preeminence is precisely its heavy burden of content, in quotes, both reportage and moral judgment. This makes it, as I say, possible for most English and American literary critics to use literary works mainly as texts for social and cultural diagnosis, rather than concentrating on the properties of, say, a given novel or play as an artwork. But the model arts of our time are actually those which, with much less content and a much cooler mode of moral judgment, like music, films, dance, architecture, painting, sculpture. The practice of these arts, all of which, and this is very important, draw profusely, naturally, without embarrassment upon science and technology, the practice of these arts is the locus of the new sensibility. How this makes me feel as a novelist, you can all well imagine. Very sad and very challenged. The problem of the two cultures, in short, rests upon an uneducated, uncontemporary grasp of our present cultural situation. It arises from the ignorance of literary intellectuals and of scientists with a shallow knowledge of the arts, like the scientist novelist C.P. Snow himself, arises from the ignorance of this new culture and its emerging sensibility. In fact, there can be no divorce between science and technology on the one hand and art on the other, any more than there can be a divorce between art and the forms of social life. Works of art, psychological forms, social forms, all reflect one another, change with each other. But of course, most people are slow to come to terms with such changes, especially today when the changes are coming with an unprecedented rapidity. I want to recommend to those of you who don't know this man and his writings that the works of Marshall McLuhan. There are two MC, capital L-U-H-A-N, a Canadian writer. He teaches at the University of Toronto. I'm sure some of you have heard of him. But he has two books out now, one called Understanding Media and the other, The Gutenberg Galaxy. These are very wild, crazy books, full of preposterous and untenable ideas and illustrations, but they are very much worth reading. And for what McLuhan, when he's right, is so astoundingly right, and uniquely so, you know, among people writing about contemporary culture and the arts and what he calls the media, that I think a lot of you, or those of you, especially the ones I've talked to, are involved with one another in the arts, really should get to know him. McLuhan has described very beautifully and with great originality, described human history as a succession of acts of technological extension of human capacity, each of which works a radical change upon our environment and our ways of thinking and feeling and valuing. The tendency, that itself is not so unusual, but the point that he makes out of it is, the tendency, he says, is to upgrade, and I'm paraphrasing him now, is to upgrade the old environment into an art form. Thus nature became a vessel of aesthetic and spiritual values when the Industrial Revolution came along. While, here I'm quoting, the new conditions are regarded as corrupt and degrading. This particular quote comes not from the two books of McLuhan that I mentioned, but from a very brilliant essay on Burroughs that he wrote in The Nation a couple of months ago. He likes Burroughs very much. He never read Burroughs before. He doesn't read much fiction at all. But he latched onto Burroughs as saying for him or illustrating for him a great many things that he wanted to say. Typically, it's only, I'm still paraphrasing McLuhan, it's only certain artists in any given era who have the resources and temerity to live in immediate contact with the environment of their age. That's why they seem to be ahead of their time. They're not ahead, they're just in contact with their own age. More timid people prefer to accept the previous environment's values as the continuing reality of their time. Our natural bias is to accept the new gimmick, say automation, as the thing that can be accommodated in the old ethical order. Only in terms of what McLuhan calls the old ethical order does the problem of the two cultures appear to be a genuine problem. It's not a problem for the most creative artists of our time. Again, here one could include very sadly very few novelists, because most of these artists have broken, whether they know it or not, with this Matthew Arnold notion of culture, finding it historically and humanly obsolescent. The Matthew Arnold notion of culture defines art as the criticism of life, this being understood as the propounding of moral, social, and political ideas. The new sensibility understands art as the extension of life, this being understood as the representation of new modes of vivacity. There's no necessary denial. I'm not denying, and neither does this sensibility necessarily deny the role of moral evaluation. Only the scale has changed. It has become less gross, and what it sacrifices in discursive explicitness, it has gained in accuracy and in subliminal power. For we are what we are able to see, hear, taste, smell, feel, even more powerfully, I should say far more powerfully and profoundly than we are what furniture of ideas we have stocked in our heads. Of course, the proponents of the two cultures crisis continue to observe a desperate contrast between unintelligible, morally neutral science and technology and morally committed human-scale art. But matters are not that simple and never were. A great work of art is never simply or even mainly a vehicle of ideas or of moral sentiments. It is, first of all, an object modifying our consciousness and sensibility, changing the composition, however slightly, of the humus that nourishes all specific ideas and sentiments. So I would say to the outraged humanists that there is, in fact, no real need for alarm, that a work of art does not cease being a moment in the conscience of mankind, as Zola defined the novel, when we understand, as I'm proposing that we do, moral conscience as one of the functions of consciousness. That the moral content of art is repudiated, but it is placed in a wider context. Sensations, feelings, the abstract forms and styles of sensibility count far more than most people have recognized. And it is to these that contemporary art addresses itself. The basic unit for contemporary art is not the idea, but the analysis of an extension of sensations. Or if it is an idea, it's an idea about the form of sensibility. The poet Rilke said in one of his letters that the function of the artist is to extend the range of our senses, and particularly today, says Rilke, to correct their radical imbalance, that imbalance by which, according to which, sight has been favored so much at the and developed so much at the expense of the other senses. And McLuhan, in this same essay on Burroughs that I mentioned, characterizes artists as experts in sensory awareness. The most interesting works of contemporary art, and one can begin as far back, in fact, as, say, French symbolist poetry, are adventures in sensation, new sensory mixes. Such an art is in principle experimental, not by default, but in principle. Not out of any elitist disdain of whatever is accessible to a majority, but precisely in the same sense that science, in the same sense but for very different motives, in the same sense that science is experimental. Such an art is also, and I don't think this is necessarily, this has to be the case, but it is in most cases, apolitical and undidactic, or one might say infradidactic. When Ortega y Gasset wrote his famous essay on the dehumanization of art in the early 20s, he described the qualities of modern art. He was thinking of things like Cubism and Schoenberg and so on. He described the qualities of modern art such as impersonality, coolness, hostility to the past, playfulness, willful stylization, absence of ethical and political commitment. He ascribed these qualities to the spirit of youth, which he thought dominated our age. In retrospect, it seems that this process of dehumanization, which Ortega, despite the way that the loaded sound that that word may have for some people, Ortega was by no means attacking it, he was defending it. But it does seem as that thing which he called dehumanization came out of something much more austere than what he thought, which was the prestige of the idea of play or sport. In fact, anguish really doesn't to me seem too strong a word to use to characterize that motive out of which the modern spirit and the arts derives. It's the anguish felt, what response other than anguish, and then perhaps subsequently a kind of painful anesthesia, and then subsequently to that perhaps wit, irony, is plausible, at least in the initial stages of our experience of the modern situation. One other response is plausible as a way of meeting the disorder of our time, its mass atrocities, and equally important for our sensibility, though much less often remarked on, this unprecedentedly rapid and accelerating change in what rules our environment from, on the one hand, the intelligible and visible, to that which is only with difficulty intelligible and is invisible. So I'm speaking now of the kind of historical changes, political changes, economic changes, and also these very far-reaching changes of our environment by technology itself. Art, which I've characterized as an instrument for modifying and educating sensibility and consciousness, now operates in an environment whose ruling principles cannot be grasped by the senses. And the discovery of this, it's always been so, but the discovery of this, I think, is of immense impact upon us. Buckminster Fuller wrote something I want to quote to you. In World War I, he says, industry suddenly went from the visible to the invisible base, from the track to the trackless, from the wire to the wireless, from visible structuring to invisible structuring in alloys. The big thing about World War I is that man went off the sensorial spectrum forever as the prime criterion of accrediting innovations. All major advances since World War I have been in the infra and in the ultra-sensorial frequencies of the electromagnetic spectrum. All the important technical affairs of men today are invisible. He's talking about technology, but I think the connection with what's happening in the arts is very clear. The old masters who were sensorialists had unleashed a Pandora's box of non-sensorially controllable phenomena, which they had avoided accrediting up to that time. Suddenly, they lost their true mastery because from then on, they didn't personally understand what was going on. And if you don't understand, you can't master. Since World War I, the old masters have been extinct. Well, that's a rather apocalyptic vision. You'll find stuff like that in McLuhan, too. As the old masters don't die that quickly. McLuhan, in his books, talks about the world being a global village linked by, you know, television, for instance. The fact remains that not everybody yet has a television set. We're not yet a global village. So there's a bit an element of science fiction in the characterization. We're talking about things that can be extrapolated, trajectories that we can see in the constituents of our experience. This is far from saying that this has happened completely at this point. Now, if it's true, and I think it is, you can penetrate the eccentricities of Buckminster Fuller's language, that in the fundamental affairs of men, from point of view of technology, economics, politics, science, we've gone off the sensorial spectrum. Just think of what electronic technology, for instance, means and what it's capable of and what impact it's already had upon the world. Nevertheless, it also remains true forever that art is permanently tied to the sensorium in some respect, and this is the tension in contemporary art. Just as one cannot float colors in space, a painter needs some sort of surface, however neutral or textureless, one can't have a work of art that does not impinge upon the human sensorium. But it's important to realize that human sensory awareness has not merely a biology, but a specific history. Each culture places a premium on certain senses and inhibits others. And the same can be argued, by the way, for the whole range of human emotions, that each culture places a premium on certain emotions and allows others or encourages others to atrophy. Here is where art, among other things, enters, and why the interesting art of our time has such a feeling of anguish and crisis about it, however playful and abstract, and ostensibly morally neutral it may appear. Western man may be said to have been undergoing a massive sensory anesthesia, a commitment of the process that Max Weber calls bureaucratic rationalization, at least since since the Industrial Revolution, with modern art functioning as a kind of shock therapy for both confounding and unclosing our senses. Think of Cage, think of, you know, Happenings, so on. One important consequence of the new sensibility, final consequence that I want to dwell on, with its abandonment of the Matthew Arnold idea of culture, has already been alluded to. The distinction between high and low culture seems much less meaningful. For such a distinction, inseparable from the Matthew Arnold apparatus, simply does not make sense for a creative community of artists and scientists engaged in programming sensations rather than in art as a species of moral journalism, which is the older notion. And anyway, art has always been more than that. Another way of characterizing the present cultural situation, its most creative aspects, would be to speak of a new attitude toward pleasure. In one sense, the new art and the new sensibility takes a rather dim view of pleasure. The great contemporary French composer Pierre Boulez entitled an important essay of his, Against Hedonism in Music. The seriousness of modern art precludes pleasure in the familiar sense, the pleasure of a melody that one can hum after leaving the concert hall, of characters in a novel or play whom one can recognize, identify with, and dissect in terms of realistic psychological motives, the pleasure of a beautiful landscape or a dramatic moment represented on a canvas. If hedonism, the kind of thing that Boulez was attacking in this essay, which came out in 1948, if hedonism means sticking with the old ways in which we have found pleasure in art, that is, the old sensory and psychic modalities, then one could say the new art that I've been talking about is anti-hedonistic. Having one's sensorium challenged or stretched hurts. The new serious music hurts one's ears. The new painting does not graciously reward one's sight, at least on first seeing. The new films and the few interesting new prose works like, say, Robrier, Burroughs, do not go down easily. The commonest complaint about the films of an Antonioni or the narratives of a Beckett or Robrier or Burroughs is that they're hard to read or hard to see, that they're boring. But the charge of boredom is really hypocritical. In fact, as far as I can see, there really is no such thing as boredom. Boredom's just another name for a certain species of frustration. And the new languages which the interesting art of our time are speaking, these languages are frustrating to the sensibilities of most educated people. They're not boring, though. They're frustrating. But the purpose of art is always, ultimately, to give pleasure, though our sensibilities may take time to catch up with the forms of pleasure that art in a given time may offer. And one can also say that balancing the ostensible anti-hedonism of serious contemporary art, the modern sensibility is more involved with pleasure in the familiar sense than ever. Someone today at lunch mentioned the contrast between the kind of art that demands this repeated reviewing, rehearing, re-seeing, like Boulez or Stockhausen or certain new films, with the kind of immediate strenuous, programmatic, immediate availability of the kind of imagery that's represented in pop art, that there seems to be almost a kind of compensatory factor that arises to balance this art, which is of difficult access and involves this elaborate skill. And I thought that was a very good point. My example was the fact that people who have what I call the new sensibility are able to enjoy the popular arts in a way that wasn't possible for serious educated people up to now. Or if they did it, they did it sort of in secret and felt that came from another part of them. Because the new sensibility demands less content in art and is more open to the pleasures of form and style, it is also less snobbish and less moralistic in that it does not demand that pleasure in art necessarily be associated with edification. If art is understood as a form of disciplining the feelings and programming sensations, then the feeling or sensation given off by a Rauschenberg painting might be like that of a song by the Supremes. I would say it is. I'd say that there's no reason in principle why it couldn't be. Why we any more have to make these old dichotomies between, you know, mass culture, serious culture. The brio and elegance of the Maltese Falcon or the singing style of Dionne Warwick can be appreciated as a complex and pleasurable event. It can be experienced without condescension. That doesn't mean it's, you know, as great as Beethoven quartets or Giacometti sculptures, but it means that it can be experienced without condescension, and that we're not ruled by a pre-existent dichotomy as to what we have to take seriously and what is mere diversion or entertainment. The last point, I think, is a very interesting one historically and in terms of understanding our own sensibility, it's important to understand that the affection which many younger artists and intellectuals feel for the popular arts is not, as has so often been charged, a new Philistinism. This is the kind of thing you get in Time and Life. It's not a species of anti-intellectualism, or it's not some kind of nihilistic abdication from culture. The fact that, let's say, all the serious American painters now are fans of the new sound in popular music, that Jasper John's record collection is mostly Supremes and Dionne Warwick and half a dozen other people, is not the fact that somebody like John's or all these other people are looking for diversion or relaxation, or that they haven't been properly educated, so it's not that they don't know about Vivaldi and Beethoven quartets. They do know about it and they like it, but they're also open to the other thing. It's, in other words, not like the fact that Schoenberg played tennis, which came from another part of his sensibility altogether. What it reflects is a new, more open way of looking at the world and at things in the world, in our world. It doesn't mean the renunciation of all standards, because of course there's plenty of stupid popular music as well as inferior and pretentious avant-garde paintings, films, music. The point is that there are new standards of beauty and style and taste. This new sensibility is defiantly pluralistic, and I very much approve of that. It's dedicated both to an excruciating seriousness and to fun and wit and even nostalgia. It's extremely history conscious, voraciously so, and the velocity of its enthusiasms and of the supersession of these enthusiasms is very high speed and hectic. From the vantage point of this new sensibility, the beauty of a machine or of the solution to a mathematical problem, of a painting by Jasper Johns, of a film by Jean-Luc Godard, and of the personalities and music of the Beatles are equally accessible, not equally valuable necessarily, but equally accessible. So I would say finally that our environment is not that of Matthew Arnold, and Matthew Arnold's categories won't do for us. I take Matthew Arnold just as a convenient example of the kind of thing that I'm talking about. And I want to just end with an admonition, first of all, to myself and then to any of you, and I think there are probably a considerable number to whom this makes sense, not to give up on the new sensibility. And to read more about it. You should read Wittgenstein, you should read Nietzsche, you should read McLuhan, you should read Artaud. But don't give up on it. If you find that it is hard to maintain, unless one is completely within it, it's hard to maintain in discussions with people, it's hard to maintain when one gets outside the sphere of one's own work and just a few people who know what you're talking about. It's difficult to live out its implications, and that's another topic altogether, because I think this has to do with the way we live our lives and has implications for that, and not just for the kind of experiences of works of art that we have. Not to give up on it, not to give up trying to understand what its implications are, even though the old one is always lying there waiting at hand, just like the clothes in your closet are waiting for you every morning when you get up. Okay.